Welcome to the St. John's College Graduate Institute Summer Lecture Series. I'm pleased to introduce today Anthony Egan, who is an alumnus of the Graduate Institute and returns today to give a talk in which he'll offer some account of how this attack on Michelangelo's David can be understood in Caravaggian terms. The talk is entitled Discernment of the Good. Please welcome Anthony Egan. Welcome. Sorry to interrupt myself and interrupt your entrance, but I should say one more thing, which is that once Mr. Egan is done speaking, we'll have a very brief break and then time for questions and discussion. All right.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's a total privilege and honor for me to speak here. It's my favorite institution, and I'd like to thank, therefore, some people before I get into the lecture. First is Mr. McDonald for making the lecture possible, and Scott Hanen for organizing it. All the tutors at St. John's, they've been supremely supportive of me, and I consider many of them friends. Specifically, Richard McCombs, who has conversed with me about Kierkegaard over the years and has been a great asset beyond that, just as a friend and a companion. And he always asks the right question when I think I understand something to make me realize I don't. So special thanks to Mr. McCombs, my mother and my father, my family for coming today, my brother who just flew in specifically for this, and my other brother who did the same. And most especially Caitlin McShay, who is incredibly supportive of me and listens to all the things I write as I work through them and try and turn the circles in my head into straight lines. Most importantly, I'd like to dedicate this lecture to Bob Richardson. He was a tutor here for many years, and he died on December 23rd. I had the pleasure of being in his preceptorial on Moby Dick, which was an incredible experience. On the journey into the text, he was the anti-Ahab, and I miss him. So that's what I'll say about Mr. Richardson. He was just a wonderful man. The topic of the lecture is Discernment of the Good, and he was a man for the task. So I'll begin. And you'll see how nervous I am by how much water I drink. Late in 2015, I was fortunate enough to spend a month in Florence with Caitlin McShay, the woman who is now my fiance. During our stay, when we visited the Accademia Gallery in order to see Michelangelo's statue of David, something peculiar happened. We turned into the room where the sculpture stands, spotted it from afar, glanced at one another with surprise, walked closer, and then each of us, separately and independently, had what Ben Lerner has called a profound experience of art. For my part, I was totally astonished by the work and overcome by a cascade of thoughts and feelings. I cannot say how long the moment lasted, but my guess is that by the clock it was several minutes at the very least. When I broke from the spell, I looked at Caitlin and saw that she was crying. In 1991, 24 years before our visit to Florence, a man named Piero Canata had his own intensely emotional reaction to Michelangelo's David. He walked into the Academy Gallery, turned into the room where the David stands, approached the piece, and attacked it with a hammer. Apparently, his profound experience of art was even more overwhelming than ours. He succeeded in shattering the second toe on David's left foot. Fortunately, other museum patrons were able to subdue him before he caused more significant damage. He was arrested shortly thereafter and then given the psychiatric benefit of the doubt. At the time, authorities in Italy called Piero Canata deranged. This word, as I understand it, suggests that the behavior of the individual in question is beyond the range of what is orderly and therefore intelligible, that he is not playing with a full deck, that he has gone mad or lost contact with reality. But what if the opposite is the case? What if Piero Canata's vandalism indicates that, in relation to Michelangelo's David, he had suddenly gained contact with reality, a reality perhaps too bottomless to withstand in silence? What if his actions are entirely intelligible if we simply take a moment to appreciate the intricacy and depth of human consciousness? While it is not my endeavor to censure Piero Canata 27 years after the fact of his crime, nor to introduce guidelines on how to rebuke all the gestures in contemporary society which may be likened in spirit to this vandalism against the humanities, it is my endeavor to form a picture of the attack as psychologically comprehensible and as developing a direct response to the awesome expressive power of Michelangelo's sculpture. As I see things, nothing in the word deranged suggests accountability on the part of Kanata, and nothing suggests a desire for explanations on the part of the authorities in their reaction to his crime. It is a lazy type of word, applied perhaps to avoid too much awareness of the fact that Piero Kanata is, like all of us, a human being, and that consequently, given the appropriate conditions, each individual in this room here today is capable of such an act. Here is a man who suffers, feels pain, struggles outwardly to express something inward and inexpressible, and endures the ceaseless passage of time without even comprehending what time really is. Here is a man who misunderstands himself and who, like the rest of us, must act on the very basis of this misunderstanding. The label of derangement, then, may function as a sort of public dissociation from the event, a denial that any so-called sane person is capable of crossing a line and destroying something absolutely precious and value-laden for no apparent reason. The word deranged can conveniently shelve the incident in the cabinet of historical oddities having little to do with the quotidian life of supposedly grounded, upright, virtuous, rational, and morally cultivated civilians. I believe that Kierkegaard would have called Piero Kanata demonic. I believe, along with Kierkegaard, that the behavior of unbalanced persons is often merely an exaggerated manifestation of the psychological tendencies latent within every individual, and that thereby looking at so-called abnormal cases actually clarifies the customary mental situation. In one of his discussions of the demonic, Kierkegaard writes that it may be viewed mistakenly, quote, under the rubrics of misfortune, fate, etc., and can then be viewed as analogous to being mentally deranged at birth. Not daring in the deeper sense to think about such things, one saves oneself by sympathy. Only when the sympathetic person in his compassion relates himself to the sufferer in such a way that when he in the strictest sense understands that it is his own case that is in question, only when he knows how to identify himself with the sufferer in such a way that when he fights for an explanation, he is fighting for himself, renouncing all thoughtlessness, softness, and cowardice, only then does it perhaps find meaning. End quote. Insofar as we are all the same species as Piero Kanata, we are all at least capable of such an act. And we ought to consider madness as an exaggerated form of sanity more frequently than we do. To brush unsavory deeds aside with a sweeping and distancing generalization suggests the contrary. It suggests that this action and this man are aberrations so distant from ourselves as to warrant no further inquiry. Today, I intend to pursue that unwarranted further inquiry. I wish to account for Piero Kanata's demonic act by understanding his vandalism as a reaction to the very same features of Michelangelo's masterpiece that inspired Caitlin's passionate response and my own reflective one. I think we can construe an identical cause for such varied emotional effects if we consider the possibility that each one of us had suddenly witnessed an exceptional synthesis between eternal and temporal elements resting transparently in the Michelangelo's creative power. Problematically, this last expression may be perplexing. What exactly is a synthesis of eternal and temporal elements? I too have been confused by the idea of such a synthesis, and in fact, I probably remain confused. Repeatedly in Kierkegaard's work, particularly in the concept of anxiety and the sickness unto death, a reader finds this paradoxical concept of the eternal temporal synthesis, and for as long as I have studied Kierkegaard, I have struggled to come to terms with it. Without question, it was the author's intention to inspire this struggle in his readers, to instigate perhaps a lifelong struggle with what he means. What is most strange, then, is that when I look back to that fine afternoon 3 years ago, to the moment when I was standing in the museum and gazing up at David, in the absolute pitch of emotional openness, I realize that I may have been shockingly clear on the issues at stake. Of course, Kierkegaard reserved the language of this synthesis for his discussion of the human self in a fallen world. And so some listeners more familiar with his work may perceive a sort of blasphemy if I appropriate his religiously oriented anthropology in order to describe a rather large piece of stone. Yet certain objects and individuals magically transcend the nature of what they are. And I think it is not far-fetched to say that of all artistic achievements, the statue of David most exceeds the actual boundaries of its medium. It is the masterpiece of the plastic arts, in my opinion. And as I intend to demonstrate, no inanimate object more perfectly suggests the value, the richness, the resourcefulness, the complexity, and the ambiguity of the human being than Michelangelo's David does. If I am even remotely right in this view, then we may be able to discover some illumination if we ponder Piero Kanata's outbreak as a demonic reaction to this artistic illustration of what a human being is. With a view to this purpose, it will be helpful if I rely upon my own personal experience in Italy in 2015. I want to come to terms with that remarkable moment of sensitivity and amazement, or what above I called my cascade of thoughts and feelings, and my profound experience of art, at least insofar as I am capable of remembering that inner event and conveying it outwardly. I have no doubt that in that museum, I too, like Piero Canata, endured a glimpse of human reality almost too burdensome to tolerate in silence. And the best way to describe it would be to say that David was, to me, both beautiful and sublime simultaneously. He was a synthesis of the beautiful and the sublime. Obviously, the potency of my experience, and a large part of the burdensome element of it, concerns the individualized flavor of my relation to the statue on that single afternoon. Yet turning to such well-acknowledged categories of aesthetic judgment to classify what happened might just get us close. The philosophical discipline of aesthetics, by which I mean the articulation into concepts of what a spontaneous experience of art or nature entails, seeks to interrogate, autopsy, and categorize those special phenomena which suddenly bring a sort of pregnant order and momentary alignment to the individual's perspective. It aspires to approximate the fertility of consciousness in our immediate perceptive experience of an object. In other words, aesthetics is a discipline that turns to the intellect to describe the emotional susceptibility and cognitive arousal that occurs in our direct relation to that object. When the soul is astounded by a beautiful or sublime phenomenon, the mind seeks to identify and preserve what has happened. This attempt at recollection is, as I see it, the principal and largely desperate aim of aesthetics. Thus, to believe that aesthetics can capture a profound experience of art is similar to believing that nutrition information can capture the taste of Argentine chocolate. However, so long as we recognize this shortcoming, it is not a totally futile enterprise to rely upon the general concepts of beauty and sublimity to bring us as close as possible to a grasp of the bewildering and ultimately incommunicable personal experience of art or nature. We simply need to remember that everything aesthetics expresses in its long-winded struggle occurs for the spectator in a single moment, in the deepest depths of the psyche, perhaps in the depths of the heart, and that in that moment, language, logic, and abstraction have nothing to do with experience. But what is the beautiful? The problem is that the harder we work towards a definition, the more and more unclear it becomes. When a child says, "This sunset is so beautiful," everyone on the patio understands, and everyone agrees, and everyone finds short-lived bliss in admiring the colorful panorama. Yet when a philosopher asks how this agreement occurs, or what is meant by this vaguely descriptive idea we have been employing since before the time of Socrates, then everyone on the patio seems to become flabbergasted. The wise ones among us change the topic or simply observe the sky. The unwise begin their diatribes. Consequently, for 2,000 years and more, the question of beauty has remained mystifying, and some of the most innovative thinkers and artists in history have written subtle and mind-blowing but nevertheless inadequate books in their attempt to grasp its strange features and even stranger impact. Generally speaking, for the modern German philosophers writing in the decades prior to Kierkegaard's time, the experience of beauty entailed an encounter with an object so attractive and formally coherent that the discrepancy between the free inner self and the causally determined external world momentarily disappeared, and nature seemed once again enchanted. In a time of subjective alienation, they felt, the perception of beauty involved a much-needed restoration of wholeness and harmony, a grounding in perceptible things. Beauty anchored the free human spirit back into the universe. After the science of Newton and friends had appeared to prove that we live in a law-governed, predictable, and deterministic world, a new crisis had arisen. If Newtonian science was right, then either the dignity of human freedom was an illusion, or our irrefutable sense of that freedom disconnected the mind from its empirical setting. And perhaps the empirical world itself was the illusion. On the one hand, we were pure beasts. On the other hand, our minds were ungrounded, like tops spinning in a void. Beauty, these philosophers felt, held a clue to the possibility that, in fact, this contradiction was navigable, that humans were both grounded and practically free. According to Kant, for instance, the judgment of beauty had the potential, quote, to bridge the great gulf between the sensible and supersensible, end quote, by which he meant between the concept of causal nature and the concept of practical freedom. As Kierkegaard put it 5 decades after Kant, and somewhat satirically, the beautiful experience is an indication that the physical world is a, quote, transparent adornment for the spirit that acts upon and operates throughout it, end quote. If all of this is the case, the beautiful always somehow finds expression within the laws of physics. Imagine an object with such impeccable and shapely material presence that momentarily our awareness of the past and future disappears, as does every consideration of essences, hidden meanings, unseen significances, and so forth. Along with these, self-consciousness proper seems to disappear. The beautiful object simply is as we behold it. And we relate to it so intensely and spontaneously, so purely aesthetically and instinctively, that it seems fleetingly to be the sole condition of our thought. This is why I say that it is the temporal criterion. In the swift moment of the beautiful, what is visible, what is apparent to our senses, or what is physically present takes hold of us as if this object is all that exists. Now, it is true that the beautiful, for so many philosophers, is a gateway to the ideal, or even the very physical presence of an ideal. This may or may not be the case. For our present purposes, there is something more crucial, namely the sense in which the beautiful starts the clock for the spectator. An abstract idea does not so much find its channel through the dimensional presence of the object. Rather, what seems to happen is that the whole cognitive category of an idea disappears, and the dimensional presence of the object becomes indistinguishable for an instant from the mentality of the perceiving individual. We intuit the perfection rather than understanding it through the use of reason. Of course, this may be defined as idealism in a more modern sense. It is the elevation of material form to the momentary totality of conscious experience, which suggests that alignment exists between the form of our understanding and the form of the object. It is as though some interior truth is discovered externally, and as a result, no thinking is necessary to feel its reality. The solitary sentiment that can accompany subjectivity melts into a congruence with an object in the visible world. And all of this takes place in a time frame at once so short and full that it cannot be calculated with any invented human quantities. The beautiful moment cannot be measured in human time simply because time is the measurement of change. In this moment, all differentiation disappears, and so change is a non-question. Consequently, time becomes a deeper issue in the ensuing repercussions of thought, which, in seeking to understand what has just occurred with respect to a physical object, yet still under the influence of the sensual event, the mind sees, so to speak, the distance growing between itself and that renewing experience of beauty, that lost fullness, that moment of timelessness and enchantment that has already passed, but that still seems close enough to capture once again, like a falling egg that, as we ineptly reach for it, has yet to hit the floor. This is why I said that the beautiful object starts the clock for the spectator. This description, you will notice, avoids the question of what really constitutes beauty and whether it is a quality in the observable object or a quality in the perceiving subject, or both. Instead, it merely shows that the object to which we attribute the category of beauty is both in time, meaning that it is something physical and subject to change and decay, and that this object can be a source of our mournful feeling for how easily what grounds us recedes further into the past. It may explain why our sense of beauty is so often accompanied by a feeling of nostalgia or even loss. As soon as the immediate experience passes, we long to get it back. And one could almost believe that that longing is the origin of self-consciousness rightly understood, if one did not also believe that self-consciousness rightly understood was not already the origin of that longing. I would guess that any listener here today who has ever experienced an astonishingly beautiful natural object has said silently and with certainty, in the moments following the pinnacle of that astonishment, if Barbara could simply experience this moment from my perspective, she would understand me completely. Or if Stephen were here with me now and knew what I felt, he would forgive me. If this is the case, then the beautiful has started the clock for you. It has severed you from your past, from all the foundations of your identity and all the events that constitute the history of your life. You can be known, supposedly, on the basis of nothing but what you observe right now. Once this feeling passes, of course, then your history and your inner dimensions slowly regain their force. You become a concrete individual again. And you may even wonder how it is that you could ever have been fooled into thinking that that special object said everything all at once and seemed to give birth to a new beginning. But the question arises, how does the beautiful object achieve this magnificent renewal for our consciousness, this moment of pure relation or total immediacy in which the past and future cease to matter? How does the beautiful object become for us in that immeasurably timeless moment all that is? I think the answer may be rather simple. It is something a reader can discover developing in the work of those very same German aestheticians, especially Kant and Schiller. If I understand these authors correctly, in their aesthetic writings, they want to stress their belief that the beautiful object bears no traces of a cause beyond itself. The spectator cannot see any indications that the object is determined or shaped by something external to it, nor any indications of a governing concept to which it is subservient, The object appears to be complete in the matter of some miraculous entity that is subject to no force whatsoever and has nothing manipulating it. No causal chain or domino effect, no missing artist, no larger idea, no tangled network of roots or wires, no unseen instruments. The object presents the illusion of absolute autonomy and self-determination. As Schiller puts it in his letters to Gottfried Kerner, which are assembled together under the title of Callias or Concerning Beauty, quote, we are neither able nor inclined to look for the ground outside of the beautiful object. It demands no explanation, or it explains itself without a concept. This great idea of self-determination resonates back at us from certain appearances in nature, and we call it beauty, end quote. Psychologically speaking, then, one reason a beautiful object is so captivating, so joyous to behold, may be that our sudden relation to it, our endless quest to know the foundation of who we are, to gain knowledge of that incalculable chain of cause and effect, is absolutely forgotten. In the human urge towards free will and autonomy, we are driven to seek awareness of the forces that created us, to learn of our origins, our conditions for living, our determinants, the measurements of our identity. We seek to know how deeply we are shaped by nature and how deeply by nurture. We pursue the principles of our consciousness, the ground of our tendencies, the circumstances of our specificity, the factors that were here before us, and those that extend beyond us. However, in the experience of beauty, this interminable quest is suspended in a moment of magnificence. In our awareness of the inexplicable absence lurking behind, within, around, and above the human self is diminished. Simply by virtue of the fact that, abruptly, we see an object that appears to be the source of itself, we relate to it with incredible intensity, and we sense that we have an unbreakable connection to a discernible origin. In other words, if the object has no conditions outside of what it appears to be, something whole and complete, with no unseen prime mover or efficient cause, then in relating to it directly, we can begin to understand ourselves as mentally conditioned by something present rather than something absent. The accompanying mood of wholeness and autonomy, then, is the meaning of the naturally beautiful object. The beautiful is the gift of groundedness. A fine example of a naturally beautiful object to behold, as I mentioned, is the setting sun. Again, just why the sunset is so beautiful is beyond conceptualization. Yet observing the sky on a serene evening, we feel we have caught a glimpse of sheer harmony and completion. The sun is the very timepiece of the human, and as even the most archaic civilizations were aware, the fountain from which all known biological life springs. Just before it touches the horizon, the sun appears in the distance as a flawless circle, our long-standing symbol for perfection. And we rejoice that what in the busy hour of our day is too bright and imposing to glimpse has become now, in our hour of rest, entirely within our perceptive capacity, even if for the briefest of moments. As we watch the silent disk slowly vanish beyond the sea, or rather as we perceive ourselves to disappear from its reaches, we marvel at the manner with which it diffuses its warm rays into every element of the visible landscape, shifting from its earlier intensity in the most painful and blinding whites to its current softness in the most healing and comforting flushes of pink and red. It is the physical captivity of a wisdom too vast for thought alone, an image too concretely formal and harmonious to permit of abstract content. We experience it, and then we search for an explanation of what that beauty was and where it was. But what is an explanation if not a search for causes? The description of beauty then only leads to its further destruction, thus a greater sense of nostalgia, a greater loss of the ground that the experience had established for us. Ultimately, in the ensuing dusk, we must confess that it is not the sun that enters night, but we, now and on our final evening. And such an embodied truth is beyond the constructive aptitudes of human reason or language. When the beautiful object is a work of art with a specific subject matter, this process is deepened by the fact that the object exists as the sensible presence of an idea the artist hopes to express, which is a Hegelian thought. In masterpieces, the form to which we directly relate is indistinguishable from the content. Because the subject matter is made instantaneously apparent to us through perception, it impacts our aesthetic or pre-theoretical intuitions, or what nowadays we might call our unconscious, with the richness of a truth as irrefutable as the heat we feel from the sun. The pleasure of the truth that is not abstracted by the process of reasoning, and thus is not rendered internally and in distinction from the empirical world, this pleasure infiltrates our hearts instantaneously, as opposed to more mundane situations when theoretical reason exerts itself to understand the given phenomenon, when the mind imperially thrusts its form upon the world, so to speak, In the situation of the beautiful, the object somehow does all of the significant work in advance of any reflection. And if the object does happen to be representational, such as would be the case with the sculpture depicting a young man about to do battle with a giant, then the meaning of this situation, of his situation, floods into the spectator without any parsing, any arithmetic, or any cognitive activity whatsoever. Thus, David's heroism, his self-exposure, his fear and confidence, his youthful eagerness, his dependability, and his willingness to face violence, all of these qualities hit us before we even consider the biblical story of David and Goliath, before we even think about what it means to be an underdog, a shepherd, a future king, etc. This suggests that the shape of David, posture, counterpoise, and glare, is familiar to us already. It matches something formal within us. Whatever he represents is already an aspect of our framework. He reveals something true about the human interiority, and he is identical somehow with the structure of our inward life. How can this be? Are we all Davids? To address this in more detail, I will have to turn to the opposing aspect of the synthesis, the sublime. Because what is fascinating about the David, as far as I am concerned, is that the presence of his form expresses something absent and formless. The result is a paradox. But before I move on to delineate what this means through an analysis of the sublime, and before I discuss the specific absence that the stone renders immediately for our intuitions, I want to emphasize that in the perfection of David's human shape, nothing explanatory is missing from our senses. When we first glance at us, he is a seamless being. When we first glance at him, excuse me, he is a seamless being, untouched and final, self-determining and absolutely physical. A major element of his beauty, then, is derived from the fact that in the first moments of perception in front of the statue, not even Michelangelo is missing. There is no signal of the artist and his activity, no sign of his hammer and chisel or his boar, nor are there any hints of his presumably endless hours of craftsmanship and his enormous industry. David looks as though he has always been shaped in this way. And since there is no suggestion of the forces and the labor that created David, we are free, as we directly observe his features in amazement, to relate to this pure object alone, as the harmony and the human truth that he expresses overwhelms us like the sunset. Unexpectedly, a moment later, after the spectator's soul recovers from the concussions of such beauty, the statue's very same completeness and absoluteness become the true indication of Michelangelo's divine craftsmanship. We are forced to remember that the David was indeed fashioned, in a historical moment we call the Renaissance, by an indisputable prodigy whose ability to render impeccable shapes into stone was the efficient cause for what we are observing now, 5 centuries into the future. In the recovery of that knowledge, the beautiful gives way to something even more mysterious, specifically to knowledge of absence, or to an aesthetic relation dependent upon otherness rather than presence or physicality. And this something else, this non-entity, proves just as fundamental to the meaning of the object as we have come to observe it. What is incredible is that this absence, this unseen influence, proves to be superior to the object which has just astonished us, that David was created by a power greater than David. The spectator's clock has started once again. In a flash, we remember that just as the object was created in time by incomprehensible forces, so too someday, in the not-too-distant future, as the result of unforeseeable causes, the breathtaking statue will be returned to dust. And as reasoning thus regains control, we begin to mourn the loss of that immediate relation to the object. And then, with the suddenness of beauty, the sublime has already gripped our hearts. But what is the sublime? Fortunately, I think this aesthetic category is more easily and quickly understood than the category of the beautiful. I mentioned earlier that the sublime is the eternal criterion. With this claim, I meant to suggest that contrary to the beautiful, the sublime always develops in counterpoint to the laws of physics and the passage of time. To put this another way, the sublime emerges despite what appears before us in time, as a hint of something in us that is transcendent and not subject to the influence of matter. The sublime feeling involves the ascension of our inner spirit over the natural order, beyond what we observe as existing before us, and thus it serves as a revelation of an internal human greatness that persists independently of what happens in the empirical world. The human spirit is capable and enduring, able to exceed the temporal framework in which it is contained, and the sublime object is an event which brings this emotionally to light. One may say it is the arousal of the eternal. Kant explains that the sublime object evinces a faculty of mind transcending every standard of sense. As usual, Schiller intentionally echoes Kant when he writes in the opening paragraph of an essay called On the Sublime, quote, "We call an object sublime if, whenever the object is presented or represented, our sensuous nature feels its limits, but our rational nature feels its superiority, its freedom from limits. Thus, we come up short against the sublime object physically, but we elevate ourselves above it morally, namely through ideas," end quote. Kierkegaard has something to say about the sublime, too. In The Sickness Unto Death, he likens the sublime to an infinite erectness of spirit, which, he points out, distinguishes the human from other creatures, quote, "in quite another way than does his erect walk," end quote. In this passage, Kierkegaard is attempting to highlight the irrefutable fact of human possibility, freedom, self-realization, goodness, love, and discernment in light of an otherwise insensitive and brutish universe. Oddly enough, it seems that this possibility is never fresher and more palpable than when nature seems to threaten us with visceral shapes too great to imagine or disasters too treacherous to survive. It certainly is noteworthy that in times of greatest calamity, the human spirit has the greatest occasion to manifest itself in its ascendancy over the given situation. Despite the causality implicit in our human conception of and susceptibility to time and space and whatever nasty forces the universe contains, or to what we might call the actual world, there is nevertheless a moral autonomy and an imaginative capacity within us that paradoxically flaunts the binding laws of this physical territory to which we are subject. When endangered or overwhelmed by the endlessly encroaching environment, we gain a stronger indication of some immaterial inwardness that is divorced from sensual stimuli, something abounding within us that can say yes or no and a million other words to anything it sees and touches. All of this is to say that the sublime feeling is the strange accomplishment of moral regeneration and subjective competence in spite of our evident insufficiency as mortals within an irrational and incalculable universe, a flourishing sense of mastery and selfhood in moments of limitation and peril. Our spiritual capacity is felt to be unvanquished by our sudden awareness of the material and necessary components of experience, and we become undaunted by the prospect of physical endangerment and bodily inadequacy. The sublime, to put it bluntly, allows the individual to catch a glimpse of the unseen freedom of the human mind or spirit, its dependence on nothing. In this sense, it is an inversion of the beautiful. Whereas the beautiful is the gift of sudden groundedness in the world, a truth out there bleeding into our passive comprehension, the sublime is the blossoming of our groundlessness, an active absence of predicates in the mind, or the gift of unchangeable freedom. The sublime object points us to something that has no definition and is not anywhere. Consider the thrill we might experience in beholding a tornado ripping across a landscape on the horizon. Even though we feel threatened and distressed as we look upon the indiscriminate whirlwind, essentially vulnerable as a prairie creature would feel, still we discern within our hearts some permanent aspect of human nature that violence cannot touch. Witnessing the tornado's destructive path thus provides us with a paradoxical feeling of moral security, of unconquerable spirit, and in the endurance and ingenuity of our discernment, which relies upon what is beyond being and thus has no objective features. In this manner, the sublime arises despite the visible or sensibly present, highlighting our ability to imbue nature with an otherwise absent entity, a non-entity, our strange human possibility. The sublime object, to borrow another term from Schiller, reveals our double relation, at once sensuous and moral. And in addition to initializing the inner gift, it can inspire us to feats so daunting that they baffle the mind, scaling Everest, taking flight, sailing alone around the world, rescuing stranded children from a monsoon-flooded network of caves, bringing down Goliath. In this connection, I should mention something I read about the Statue of David in Giorgio Vasari's The Lives of the Artists. Vasari knew Michelangelo and held him in the sort of esteem usually reserved for a god. When he describes the genesis of the Statue of David, he mentions that the single piece of marble Michelangelo used was spoiled, unwieldy, already discarded as unfeasible by two other artists, and perceived to be a total burden by those who knew of it. From this gargantuan and physically fearsome density of rock, Michelangelo crafted the most sensually marvelous sculpture known to man, in effect becoming the quintessential artist, a David in his own right to the Goliath that is the recalcitrance of stone. the morally enriched subjugator of physical limitation. Michelangelo could have crafted the marble into any possible shape. In his discernment, this flawless David is what he saw and then carved into the world. And I believe that somehow the spirit of this sublime victory imbues the piece with a special aura, an artistic reverberation of the David-Goliath subject matter, which is to say that Michelangelo must have channeled the divine inspiration of the biblical content the more perfectly to embody its essence into the obstinacy of previously lifeless stone. As Vasari so eloquently wrote, quote, "Michelangelo certainly performed a miracle in restoring to life a block of marble left for dead," end quote. So if the sublime is the conquest of human consciousness over the might and immensity of nature, this category applies to the statue's biblical content, to David's voluntary confrontation with the awesome and physically overpowering Goliath. The spirit of David is the spirit of the unvanquished man of faith, grace, and dependable moral resolve. David, as depicted in the first book of Samuel, has the archetypically sublime temperament. And the story of his confrontation with the substantially superior Goliath highlights the spiritual force within all of us that does not feel itself bound by the conditions of a merely substantial and law-governed milieu. Precisely by emphasizing this moral supremacy over the evidently superior forces of nature, by trusting in some inner spirit, something absent from the world, and turning to it with ingenuity, David is able to conquer Goliath with a sling and a stone. David's physically beautiful form, as I have said, does not stand unaccompanied by this idea. The sculptural medium is merely a transparent adornment for the spirit that acts upon and operates throughout it. To phrase it slightly differently, again relying upon Kierkegaardian language, there is a, quote, mutual permeation, end quote, of form and subject matter. The concept of the sublime hero is too powerful and too powerfully expressed by Michelangelo to allow for the spectator's purely sensual appreciation of its dimensions to persist in a conceptual vacuum. As such, the David becomes the sensory presence of the moment when the future king of Israel stands between his decision to confront Goliath and his knowledge of the outcome. He is poised between the past and the future. In the tension and ambiguity of the undecided outcome, young David embodies the ideals of openness to possibility, trust in the unseen, courage, grace, and accountability for the entire community. Yet he is not unafraid or cavalier. In partial contrast to his open and confident posture, his face discloses a respect for the enemy he beholds with simultaneous apprehension and bravery. His outer vision is witness to the fact of Goliath, while his inner vision is witness to the fact of human spirit. In short, the beauty of the sculpture is the sensible presence of the sublime. The material form somehow embodies the transcendence of material forms. This is what Kierkegaard sometimes calls the tension of the opposing form. Just as with conversational irony, for instance, where the language and the meaning of the language are totally opposed, and yet the hidden meaning is still conveyed to the listener, so too does the beauty of David reveal its opposite. When we look at David, we are grounded into groundlessness, presenced into absence. It is a paradox. What is remarkable when we look at the face of Michelangelo's David, and even his perfect pose, is that his overall attitude is not one of indifference to the physical world, as seems to be the case with so many spiritually oriented figures represented in the history of religious art. These so-called monastic figures whose regard for the physical and temporal is minute or even non-existent. For instance, the martyr who, although pierced with arrows, maintains a stoic expression. In David, every fiber of his rippling body and in every wrinkle on his brow, we see that everything depends upon this moment in which he intends to infuse his own limitations with a spirit that is beyond his brute capacity. He discerns in the world that which is not present, and upon this, his whole body and attitude suggests he is able to rely. In a few seconds, he must believe he will manifest the eternal for the good of his community. But first, he must get beyond the conditions of his being. He will transform the actual world by virtue of the unseen possibility residing within him. I am suggesting that David in the sculpture is heroic in a different sense than we are generally accustomed to acknowledging when we hear the expression David and Goliath. He is the underdog, yes, but he is not yet victorious. Rather, he is more heroic than the victor, simply by virtue of his belief in the possibility of an incongruous conquest. He is heroic for overwhelming his sensual fear with the faith that he can take down Goliath. And when looking at the statue of David, one must say the same of Michelangelo. Not only does Michelangelo's sculptural interpretation of the hero echo the same victory of spirit over matter, in this case, the victory of one man's artistic vision over incredibly solid rock, but also the spectator must feel that Goliath is to David what marble is to Michelangelo. And this is not mere projection. I encountered this drawing after I wrote that, actually. This is in the Louvre. This is a sketch of Michelangelo from 1501, just when he was about to begin David. This is a sketch for a bronze David with David's foot on the head of Goliath. That sculpture is now lost. This is the sketch for the marble arm, almost exactly as it is, as we know it now. And here, Michelangelo writes, let me quote, "David with the sling, and I with the Colarco, Michelangelo." And the Colarco is basically, if you picture a bow and arrow, it's a bow in which you stick a boar and you wrap it in the string so that you can do fine-tuning sculpture on marble. So the boar rotates at extremely rapid pace. So he seemed to feel the same way. In this David synthesis, the sensuous presence and the moral force infinitely strengthen one another in oppositional tension. One is tempted to say that they negate each other in an infinite sequence, but this terminology is unsatisfactory since it ignores their simultaneity. While the eternal idea of David outpaces the temporal embodiment Michelangelo has created, the voluptuous presence is so striking that one is overawed by its greatness. In a sort of vortex, the beautiful and the sublime each ascend at the expense of the other by virtue of the other's secondary status in the relation. But the one only achieves its respective superiority by virtue of the other's prior superiority and its role as the tensing element or relation. Wholly speaking, David is a synthesis between the two, a third entity arising from the otherwise impossible combination of what is seen and what is unseen. And of course, David rests transparently in the power that created him, Michelangelo's genius. Kierkegaard never saw the statue of David. I think it is fair to say, though, that he believed we were all, at every moment of our lives, poised as David is poised in the sculpture, straddling between these two positions with complete anxiety. For Kierkegaard, it was our infinite task to bestride the line between necessity and possibility, between the temporal and the eternal, between the outer and the inner, between the past and the future. Even if we deny it, our challenge is as great as David's, to confront what grounds us with an ungrounded spirit, to face our conditions with the belief that we can condition them. Our challenge is also as great as Michelangelo's, to carve the material world towards expressions of the good with our infinitely creative capacity, to turn the temporal into evidence of the eternal. The masterpiece in Florence makes it abundantly clear to us on the level of emotion that our permanent condition is Davidian. Our deepest reality of being is too paradoxical to be thought, but not too paradoxical to be felt. We live in ambiguity, and this is why we experience anxiety. It is our task to turn the nothing, or the non-presence of the eternal, into the something or presence of the temporal. And yet, in our epistemic limitation, we have no idea how this can ever occur. We stand poised between the given situation and the unseen possibility, and forced, as it were, to bring this possibility into the actual world. The task is sublime. It seems unmanageable since possibility is nothing and nowhere, and yet we are completing the task right now. We did it yesterday, and we will do it tomorrow. That is what it means to be in the present for Kierkegaard, that inescapable, ever-progressing time frame in which determinism and freedom copulate. As I stared at David in 2015, this vortex of thought overtook me, and I believe I experienced what Kierkegaard would call Ublicket, the glance of the eye, by which he meant the moment in which time and eternity touch one another. The seeming contradiction emerges emotionally or purely aesthetically when one is looking at David. Michelangelo's touch has made it evident that we are simultaneously subject to time and not subject to time, simultaneously conditioned and unconditioned, simultaneously determined and free. I believe that, even for those spectators who are perhaps slightly less reflective than I, this can all happen intuitively. I believe that this is why Caitlin was brought to tears. I believe this because 2 years after seeing the David together, she and I were in a pub in York, England, discussing a friend of ours who insists that the human being is fully determined. In a moment of inspiration, I said to her, "No one can look at the statue of David and fail to believe that human beings are free." The same tears I had seen in 2015 returned to her eyes. Such is the sublime power of Michelangelo. Let's turn now, in conclusion, to Piero Canata's seemingly different reaction. As I have suggested, I believe the destructive tendency Canata exhibited can be seen as an example of what Kierkegaard calls the demonic, or interchangeably, anxiety about the good. That is, I wish to suggest that Piero Canata, far from being removed from reality, was merely suffering from a reaction to anxiety that diminishes one's inclination and aptitude for meeting the challenge of being a creature subject to time and yet responsible for that which is beyond time. It would be helpful if I identify anxiety, generally speaking, as the unpleasant mood in which the individual detects a tension between the contradictory elements of his or her being, and as such begins to experience the panic of having an ineradicable and unified self that is nevertheless concretized within time, a hidden self that is also visible, a self that is responsible for itself and simultaneously dependent upon the external and transcendent forces that shape it, a self that is constant and yet under a process of change, a self that is defined by both necessity and possibility, a self that is already realized and also self-realizing. Anxiety is most palpable in Kierkegaard's picture when these paradoxes intensify, or when the two elements of the synthesis, the eternal and the temporal, are in highest tension. Despair, on the other hand, which Kierkegaard sometimes calls the sickness unto death, is the mood in which the anxious individual has renounced the possibilities or actualities that arise from the harmonic concurrence of these opposed elements. Despair results from our efforts to overcome the unpleasant mood of anxiety, or what is the same thing, from the unpleasant task of having to navigate a causally understood external world with the inner freedom of a subjective, isolated consciousness divinely gifted with infinite possibility. Just as a fatigued person may prefer the comforts of a sickbed to a taxing week at work, so an anxious person may prefer the comforts of despair to the taxations of anxiety, because anxiety is, as it were, both the most disagreeable feeling and the ever-lurking indication of the greatest challenge imaginable. We tend to prefer and accept the defeat of our best spiritual interests in order to escape the distress of anxiety and the conscious recognition of our perpetual task as individuals. It is simply easier to release the tension in the synthesis by disregarding one of its energizing polarities than it is to remain fully charged in the face of human time. Yet anxiety is the foundational disposition of the individual, according to Kierkegaard, and thus to hide or escape from its grip is to surrender one's claims to wholeness of self, to neglect one's eternally renewing possibility, and to sacrifice the range of blessings we have received in our special situation as human beings. To escape or hide from anxiety, simply put, is to do injustice to what is good, to deny the true content of human life, and to hide from the fullness of our sublimely beautiful existence. Naturally, one simple way to hide is to ignore what is eternal and therefore unseen, and to doubt the presence of those spiritual values that sustain us and render positive communication with others possible. This is because in an impermanent world, the balance of all visible evidence indicates that experience is nothing more than a sum of traumas, losses, horrors, and sufferings. Whether we direct our vision to the indifferent and often catastrophic violence of nature, or the tragedies of family life and the devastating bereavements that accumulate over time, or to the class of nations, or to the fact that from the moment of birth, we are destined for sickness, illness, senility, and death, the temporal and visible world seems to parade before us the supremacy of misery, meaninglessness, decay, corruption, and the ceaseless renewal of pain. In short, the temporal world appears to be what it is, temporal. As Ecclesiastes puts it, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Yet this claim precisely is what Kierkegaard would identify as demonic. Quote, rebelling against all existence, the demonic feels that it has obtained evidence against it, against its goodness, end quote. The demonic individual, in this case, let us think of Piero Canata, wills to see no more than what is present on the surface. He is unwilling to redirect his vision towards the deeper content of human life, towards the obvious if mysterious reality that, in fact, this temporal decay sharpens a pain that is spiritual and thus not subject to time, a pain that, in fact, endures across time. That this pain itself is evidence of a hidden and spiritual inwardness beyond time is almost undeniable, for if we do not endure spiritually across the vicissitudes of experience, why should it concern us now to know that the future will bring more heartache, more loss, more agony, and more sorrow? And yet to admit this simple fact introduces an unwelcome task. The task of understanding our knowledge of pain as indicative of something potentially good, even as something transcendent or divine or blessed. It is infinitely more convenient to be lethargic, to blame the world for all of our woes, to close ourselves off against interiority, to ignore the eternal elements that weave through this temporary life. In his convenient ignorance to this rather obvious fact, the demoniac succumbs to inertia. This is why Kierkegaard calls anxiety about the good a state. The more a man like Piero Canata hides from anxiety by burying evidence of the eternal within himself, the easier it is to ignore the task of maintaining the tension in the synthesis. And in a vicious cycle, the more demonic he becomes, the more obscure the eternal is to his eyes. What such individual who has spent half a life paying heed only to the obvious facts of the world, to the easy narratives, to the effortlessly understood details of suffering? What such individual can have the sublime energy to say that a self in the world is good, that consciousness is good, that it is worth loving others who may not be here tomorrow, that it is worth being an earnest member of a community striving towards something worthy, stable, strong, and graceful? Here is Kierkegaard's masterstroke. This unconsciously attained attitude leaves a demoniac like Piero with one major vulnerability. He feels certain he is not exposed, for in his despair, he has covered up hope and accepted defeat in advance, so that further suffering will only vindicate his cunning intelligence and prove him right. What could be more intellectually convenient than to cite pain as your category of truth, creating an avalanche of confirmation bias whenever something goes wrong? But this is where his vulnerability is so dangerous, for what if suddenly Piero catches a glimpse of a perfect eternal temporal synthesis somewhere in the world, not in himself, which he has successfully hidden away, but out there in the world of evidence. While he has suppressed the eternal within himself, camouflaging the obvious task it would otherwise reveal, such suppression is not so easily achieved in the outward relation, when the eternal and unvanquished is made miraculously apparent within a flash of beauty. In the case of Piero Canata, I submit, the miraculously apparent synthesis stood there before him, embodied in 17 feet of exquisite marble. And within that marble trembled the spirit of David, the hero who, like Michelangelo, was able to see and manifest the unseen. What happens if the demonic individual glimpses a masterpiece so overwhelmingly beautiful and sublime that sight of the eternal good becomes undeniable within time? What if the synthesis of the eternal and the temporal becomes instantaneously real for him? And thus the nature of selfhood becomes apparent as well. Won't the sudden resurgence of his anxiety be too overwhelming, given his atrophied and forgotten ability to deal with it? In such a case, I think the demoniac may experience an irresistible impulse to destroy the value-laden object in order to escape anxiety and the call to moral resolve. Perhaps he would shatter the miracle to little bits with a hammer. As Kierkegaard puts it so succinctly, the individual might attempt to, quote, neutralize the externality, end quote, that reveals the eternal. Even if the eternal has no actual existence, it is still here just beyond the world, waiting to be discerned. It is in art and poetry, in friendship and family, in erotic love, in language, in community, in nature, and in cocktail parties. It is still here in the world to be felt, in our inescapable present, in the structure of consciousness itself, in the fact that our moral freedom and creative capacities endure no matter how demonically we react to their challenges. It is here to be discovered through an awareness that in our limited perspective, we can neither escape time nor relinquish an unlimited sense of ever-enduring, ever-renewing possibility. Consequently, the more our community of individuals is given to discern the beautiful and the sublime in this life, and to discern the manner in which these opposed factors are paradoxically but elegantly related within us, the better equipped the individuals of our community may be to face, to understand, and to employ the good that is everywhere waiting to be seen. I would like to close with a question about discernment then. In what way can we apply the lessons apparent in the David and in Kierkegaard's theory of the self, not to point fingers at the misbehavior of our contemporaries, who can be vandals in a myriad of ways, but to examine in what manner our own behavior, in anxiety, in despair, in suffering, in cowardice or laziness, or in flashes of the demonic, may in fact contribute to bickering and polarization, to violence, to anger and sadness, to the unnecessary destruction of what is valuable, and to the mistreatment of humanity's most astounding, enriching, and value-laden objects, persons, and beliefs. In what way can Michelangelo and Kierkegaard help us to see that every moment in this life is a true moment, namely an inexplicable present in which beauty and sublimity touch, and together rest transparently in the power of their creation, the individual human being? Thank you.